This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Chris, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Well, hello, everyone. I am Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show. We are streaming live on Revolution Radio. And please do remember that Revolution Radio is a supported network, and they really do deserve your support. New American Dream, we have a new American Dream. Not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. A country where people help each other. People work together to solve problems. People talk to each other. People love each other. That's what we're all about. My first guest of the evening tonight is Ava Bird. Ava joins me in this fourth week each month. And Ava is a wonderful poet. We look forward to speaking to Ava shortly. I think she's in California, but she might be on the East Coast. You never know. Anyway, hopefully we will get to her momentarily here.
Please leave your message for 424-200-4.
Well, we're going to have to try that again. When I spoke to her earlier, she said she was driving, but hopefully we can get her onto this call. Here we go again.
Please leave your message for 424-200-433.
Well, perhaps we'll adjust our order a little bit, and I will play a pre-recorded interview with Frank Cordero, and then I'll try to get hold of ABBA. So I spoke with Frank earlier today, and it was a very interesting interview. I think you'll enjoy it. Here we go. Frank Cordero from the Des Moines Catholic Worker.
Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I just got out of the shower, and I was thinking about, you know, how I was going to rant and rave today on your show, and
okay.
Hell, you're calling on time. That's so rare. So,
geez.
No. You're always within 30, 40 minutes, more or less. And that's great. That ain't bad.
Yeah.
So it's great to talk to you again. I'm out here. I got one shoe on, one shoe off. I just got out of the shower. At my house, which is like across the alley from the main house, so I can go out here and take a look out the window and see there's people outside in the yard. It's a hopping day. A lot of food served, a lot of food going to be served. I'm just starting to sit on people so they don't get out of hand. That's part of the scene, but that's in their hands. I'm over here at the house. I'm talking to you, and I've been thinking about my, I'm kind of an obsessive guy, and I really am I'm a Jesus freak. So what's been going on for me? I get excited about reading the Gospels and praying the 5 days a week we do, and contextualizing the text in the way I've learned over the years to do so. And I think it's a distinct way, and I have a word for it. I think I've tried it before and didn't do it well. There's a thing called literature, human literature, is what I'm talking about. And it's tied to the written word. Not exclusively the written word, especially today, but when human beings, as we know them, were engaged in inventing the written word, human literature began. And the whole idea of human literature for me is basically is some effort by a human being to express some sense of purpose and meaning. That's it.
Okay.
And so the people who first used the written word were the wealthy herdsmen who basically were looking for a way to keep track of IOUs. So if you had a collection of IOUs, you had one of the first genres of human literature. That was the first functional thing that the text did. And soon after that, stories, tribal stories, whatever stories. But they started to write them in a way that was compository to the time they're at. They didn't have any philosophical genre written. There were no historical novels, as they say. But there certainly were texts that intersect with human beings trying to get a grapple on purpose and meaning. And soon they attached some sense of a God. Soon they attached some sense of what would you call it? I would call it money, wealth, and war and empire. Once human organizations started to put themselves in that kind of formation, they had a whole literature along with it that justified it, divinely justified their wealth, their wars, and their victory and empire. Now, if you lose, that's another way of God saying, the God of War saying, too bad, you lose, you're not my winner. I've chosen another. But the God of War did its thing. I only say that because by the time the Jews got on board to start writing, this experiment in human literature, at least in the Middle East, was 2,000 years old. And so there's, in one sense, nothing new they can write about. And indeed, they, when they started to engage in the human literature aspect, they borrowed from the existing human literature and the genres of their day. And the cosmos of our day, you know, they believed in a flat earth scene, and they believed in heaven, and they believed in spirits, and, you know, you name it. All that's going on in these Jews, the thing about the Jews is that, again, I've said this before, is they always press that they're historical people. They're so important because they're historical. Now I understand what that means. At least, by virtue of it has its own word, and this thing called the Old Testament, which is recorded texts that have these Jewish people living through 5 to 4 different imperial empires, beginning with the Egyptians, in which that was their original empire. But they didn't really start writing until they had a writing class. Hmm. Writing classes only belong to imperial temple-based people who did the studying and the scribes and the Pharisees, as we would say. And King David, King Saul, that's when the Jews they got a temple and they started writing. Sure, they collected all their oral things and whatever you want to call it, but whoever was writing it had an edge, and they had an axe to grind. And they were saying a lot of stuff in their texts. I like it all. I love it all. There's a lot of ambiguity about empire in the Old Testament. Just say it. A lot of ambiguity about wealth and war. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Sometimes God's for it, sometimes God's not. But there always seems to be some kind of position vis-a-vis empire, where they're at, where they're living, who they're up against, who's controlling them, who are they trying to get away. That's always part of the subject going on all the time. All right, so that's human literature, and they've done some great stuff unpackaging what we both call the Old Testament. Now, the New Testament, man, that's a different animal altogether. It is a hybrid of everything that was going for the Jews as they developed into from Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, and now Roman Empire. This is the New Testament, and it's yet another war that the Jews are in, and it's an ultimate war. The Jewish people, by the time they got to the first century, were an imperial religion. They were all over the empire. And when they went to war with the Jews, the Romans went after them all over the empire, beginning with the temple in Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and then they'd have these mass killings at different times in the major metropolitan, smaller cities of Jews, liquidating a war on the Jews. It wasn't, that's all going on in the first and second century when the text is being written. And it gives you, if you don't have that sensitivity when you bring it to the text, that's why my little image thing I use, to explain how I read the Gospels or the Bible different than most people do. Most of our theologians, most of our denominations read the Bible through the lens of theology, knowledge, and truth. And there's a lot of theology and knowledge and truth in the text. But if you don't know the larger context, the literature context of what the Gospels are, what's going on in a literature way, so much more than dogma. No dogma can catch it because it's grabbing so many different conflicting kind of themes, like, for example, the Son of Man. It sounds like an innocuous thing, a human one, but this is very specific. The Son of Man is the human one that's going to stand with God on God's right side and judge the human race when they come to judgment. That's no small thing. And then in the text, they say he's the suffering servant. Hold on, what do you mean suffering servant? You can't be the judge sitting at the right hand of God and be the suffering servant, the guy who they worked this guy out in captivity in Babylon, where they go to bat for the poor and the defenseless at their own risk and peril, and they take it on all nonviolently, the throwback from the system. What's that mean? And then he's also, they call him the Messiah. Mm-hmm. Now listen, baby, the Messiah had political stuff going on. Mm-hmm. You know, what's that all about? How can he be the Messiah? And there was no way that this guy, if there was any kind of political thing going on when they were formulating the text, it was the war with the Romans. And if politically, the right thing for them to do would have sided with the Jews. Mm-hmm. Help the Jews fight the Romans. They did not.
Huh.
Wow, that is really amazing. And all throughout this time, there is not one piece of architect or ownership or building or temple or anything that smacks with wealth, war, or empire that is identified with the group of people, whoever they were, that wrote the New Testament.
Hmm.
That's all I got to say.
Hmm.
And when I was a priest, I routinely would, you know, get up in the middle of some retreat. And they always would have some priest or bishop or somebody who would say, man, this weekend we're going to focus on Jesus. And I'd like to laugh because I would say this eventually. Look, I don't get it. The guy I read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John does not have an institutional bone in his body. And we do nothing but protect and defend our institutions.
Mm.
And if we could do that and follow Jesus, I'd be all right with it. But we're not. And worse yet, we don't see it.
Mm.
Sins of omission.
Yeah.
So I'm very frustrated all the time.
Mm.
And I'm so grateful for these, for Austin and a new kid, Taylor, is coming around to pray. That's nice. Me and Eddie and Bob Cook, the old guys. And it's, well, I may well be delusionary, but I'm doing it biblically. And I wouldn't be the first delusionary biblical guy out there. Believe me, a lot of them really are.
That's for sure.
And a lot of them made it in the book.
Yeah.
God bless them.
All right.
Well, that was my kind of exegesis. Like, I'm working on this. I'm quite taken up by it.
Yeah.
All.
Well,
I'm loaded with you all this week. It was a biblical kind of a summary of how Frank reads the text.
Uh-huh. All right. Well,
yeah.
Very, very interesting, Frank, and a lot to think about.
You're kind. Well, and it's another, and I'm another chunk. You can just fill into the and go to the bathroom. God bless you.
Always good to have a chance to do that.
Amen. All
right, thank you, God, Frank. I really
thank you.
Appreciate
all right.
You.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, interesting presentation there by Frank Cordero. Definitely something to think about. All right. I got in touch with Ava Bird, and we're going to add her in right now.
Hi, Chuck.
Well, hello, Ava.
Hey, sorry
all
about
right.
that.
Oh, well, that's, you know, these things happen. I'm glad that we finally managed to connect here.
Yes, me too. And I apologize about not being there for you when you called earlier. I mean, it's kind of a crazy time and month. I can't believe this whole month has gone by without me really acknowledging much about National Poetry Month, which it is this month. April is National Poetry Month, and
right.
I actually haven't done enough, frankly, to. You know, to honor and recognize it, but I figured I would do a special tonight, a poetry special, not just a poetry special, but a Throwback Thursday poetry special.
Okay.
The moment you and Lorraine have been waiting for several months while I babbled about other stuff and didn't keep up with my book here. But I just wanted to give you an update. I did, you know, my cat book is going to be ready pretty soon. And I got some illustrations. Oh. Yeah. And it's almost done. I'm really excited. And I'm sure you'll help me get it up on Amazon, Chuck.
Sure. You know I will. I'd be very happy to.
Yeah. And with the cover and some other things, too. But I'm just trying to, you know, I'm still working on, you know, just completing the illustrations and the layout of it, which is looking good. But what I'll do is we'll go back 2 years. What I thought I'd do is go back and do a Throwback Thursday for the very first chapter of this novel, which was right when the fake pandemic started in March. This is at start of March of 2020. Pretty much that's when it was.
I think so. February or March, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Yeah, there was sort of a range of when they, you know, they started announcing it in February, but I think the lockdowns actually really started in March, and then in April it got, you know, this month pretty escalated. But
I think you're right.
Yeah. Florida's been in the news a lot, Chuck. Your home state.
Oh, yeah.
As it always is.
Especially Florida man stories.
Something really weird happened in Florida, I think, with the, didn't they have a cut up Uber Eats driver somewhere in Florida? Did you hear about that?
I did not.
Some nut. Yeah, some nut. And I won't go on and on because I know we got poetry to do, but. It's, you know, news of the weird. A lot of weird stuff happens in California, for sure. But a lot of weird stuff happens in Florida. But anyway, there's a lot of wonderful stuff that happens in California and in Florida, too. So it's like you got to take the light with the dark. You know, it's like the dark loves the light. The dark needs the light, needs some light. So, you know, of course, the dark energies are going to be attracted to the light, and you have places with a lot of sunshine, a lot of natural light. You're going to get your share of nuts, you know, and you're going to get your share of good people, too. So it's just maintaining the balance and accepting that things are not going to be this utopia just yet on this planet. You know, that's what sometimes I know we talk about it a lot on the show, and I know this the channel Revolution Radio talks a lot about this stuff, but it's just that we could and should have such a better world, and it's not complicated or difficult. That's what's so frustrating, is like we're going through this stuff and we don't have to be going through it, you know. It's like the man behind the curtain, you know. But anyway, watch the little slaves fight amongst each other about petty little things. You know, but okay. So I'm sorry to go off on that tangent. Okay,
no, that's cool.
Yeah. April 2nd, 2020. This goes back. This was written. This was the very first chapter of the cat book, which is The Lockdown Cat. The cat, for those that don't know about this project, is we had a cat that was locked in lockdown, stuck with humans. And from the cat's perspective, this is what the cat wrote.
Ah.
Meow, meow, hiss, hiss, scratch, scratch. I am the family house cat. So I know you already know who the boss is around here. I must rise from my lair and roar my truth. I am not a dog nor a human, so I'm not a snitch. I don't care about your drugs, your laws, your cheating, or the police. I'm the big top queen of the neighborhood, and I must sound the alarm to save their sorry souls. I can't believe these people. This is a horror show. This is my house, and I've watched and watched, stared and stared, pawed and pawed, purred and purred, tried to tell them through telepathy, knocking things over, waking them up in the middle of the night, and leading them to the answers. I can't believe how dumb these animals are. Are they even animals? Now they think they've come down with something. They're paranoid and shitting scared. I'm sick of them sitting around so much lately. They're here all the time now. They don't move. They don't budge. They were barely tolerable before, but now they won't leave even for their useless, silly, screaming, drooly happy hours. Thirsty Thursdays and boring Sunday fun days. They stink up the bathrooms and think they can go around not showering and assume no one notices. I notice. I smell them. I am offended. I keep myself immaculate. I'm a cat. Always perfect. Always clean. Always sleek. Always pristine. Always soft. Always regal and beautiful. I am insulted to the whiskers to share space with these cretins. Half of my days are spent cleaning my precious fur. I once had some hope for these two-legged things, but I've lost faith. They refuse to see the obvious. They stare silly-eyed into a box and scream and cheer over flying objects going nowhere. I at least play and enjoy my prey for dinner. I have some fun with it. I've stayed clean and quiet long enough. They are sitting on my pillows and laying all over my beds. They used to get up early and leave and be gone all day. It was so nice when they weren't around. So quiet and peaceful. What the hell happened? Now they can't stop talking and blabbering about some kind of virus. Their new trendy pandemic. The new drama to obsess on. Keeping them from doing the important things. I should have clean water without fluoride and arsenic in my bowl. I shouldn't have MSG and GMOs in my food. This is sacrilegious to my kind. I am wild and pure. I am all natural. Another hoax to keep them in fear. Since I am the king of the jungle, such sentiments are laughable. They are so afraid of each other that they don't leave my house. I keep hearing the same words over and over. Corona, pneumonia, flu, pandemic, COVID-19. Sounds like a patented name with an agenda. COVID-19 sounds awfully suspicious. Two new fancy names with so many symptoms and getting so much attention. All of a sudden, governments care so much. So strange. I smell the CDC. My whiskers feel the CIA. Corona and COVID plus CDC and CIA equals something really worse than a rat. I smell a hoax. I refuse to be hypnotized by the lies. Out of nowhere, they want to keep people safe, secluded, isolated, over a cold. And then they tell them a Chinese peasant ate a bat and crashed the global economy. And they ate the bait. They accepted martial law over a parasite, a microorganism, a cough. I, the cat, could see clearly, and my vision isn't even that great, but my survival instincts are the best. The flu is being used as a PSYOP clown train cover for the globalist colossal failure and the looting of the treasury in the name of stimulus. We care. Change. I heard that in 2008, too. I was only a kitten, but I saw that clown had a different costume on. He was cooler than the orange clown. He was a black clown and sounded smoother, but actually did more damage than the freak show circus act. He was also part white. The slaves bought it. The white, black, yellow, brown, gray slaves all sucked it down and clapped and smiled on their way to the slaughter. Slavelandia has never been so easy to control. These human slaves are one thing when I am the master. After all, I deserve it, and I am harmless. But when they bow to the demon gods of ABC, CBS, the idiot box pimping fascism and murder, this is unacceptable and unbearable. I am embarrassed by these Neanderthals. I am a proud hunter and king of the jungle. I take care of my family and am self-sufficient without being a burden on the planet. These animals are fed by phony baloney, money, materialism, consumerism. They let a little bug send them into a frenzied state of hysterical hermits. What an insult to the earth. And then, insult to injury, they disturb my precious hearing and ears with that blaring, beaming idiot box that screams out obscenities, outright silly lies, and wrong weather reports. The weathermen are paid patsies to talk about wind and drizzle, and yet never mention the elephant in the china shop. The streaking bloody herpes blisters plastered across the beautiful sky that I call chemtrails. I can't get away from the insanity. Hiding under the bed won't do it either. I still hear their bleeding blather leaking from every corner. The basement is no escape. There's an idiot box in every room. Today they sat staring at it like a mental patient while shoving poison in their traps. Something I wouldn't even sniff. I am cat. I am smart. I am king. Again, these animal others are an abomination in my jungle. I do try to escape, but every house trap is the same. They tell the tell-lie vision is the slave's master, even above me. They spend hours staring at it rather than me. Though I am gorgeous, they cannot keep their eyes off this boring box. They laugh and cry like a Pavlov dog. They drool over slop. Spicy chicken McFlurry, double-double whopper foot-long baconator diabetic coma. I tried to save them, but they seem too stuck on stupid to realize the sleek royalty, street smarts, and survival wisdom. This week has been especially difficult on me. They still are not leaving my castle. They're starting to smell. The idiot box is telling them that this bug is contagious. Stay home. They're afraid of a little bugaboo. One swipe with my paw, and this fantastical fad of fantastic gory fallacies of gruesome pharmaceutical terrorism would be thrown into the trash heap of the ancients with the other historical barbarisms like religions and the world wars for business bankers' profits. One calls out Hookshot and the medical CIA known as the FDA and CDC and who's spreading their diseases made in labs under microscopes. Just look it up. Fort Detrick experiments and virus manufacturing for kicks, drugs pushing on kids and infants, the con of vaccines, the real threats like Bill Gates and Google, their economic warfare machine against the world with needles and search engines, shadow banned. It's big time media's big moment to get shine in those minds. Get in those minds. The fluoride, cake the third eye, the public trust points. That same old familiar monster. But I wouldn't be caught dead believing this. Or wearing a mask and gloves. I'm a clean feline, and I'm getting tired of all this. In fact, I'm shocked. You should be, too. It's time for my paw-licking face wash and a nap, so I'll be back later with more truth and consequences from the pit boss, the family house cat.
All right.
Chapter one. Chapter one. And we got 24
that's
months.
That's a classic. I mean, really. I love it. All right.
Thank you. Lorraine. I know Lorraine's been waiting for a good poetry.
Yeah,
a good poetry.
She
set.
Enjoyed that too.
Good.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really look forward to just seeing the wonderful cat series as a book. I think it's going to be quite something.
Yeah, I'm trying to get it out before, you know, like while it's still, you know, while we're still living under this virus terror, you know,
right.
It's still around. And who knows, they might come out with another one, you know? So, but yeah, I'm excited about it. And I think maybe next month I'll read a new chapter. Cause I know I haven't been reading my chapters lately. We've been talking about other stuff.
No,
and that's been important
I know.
Too.
Yeah. And I love talking about the other stuff too, but, yeah, I have missed the cat. So.
Yeah. And I miss it too. But you know, I'm getting back into it because I'm getting the book done, and I'm adding the finishing touches on, you know, like the last chapter and stuff. So,
well, that sounds great.
How much more do we have? Any time left?
Yeah, we started late, so we can go up to another 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay, good. Again, I want to apologize about creating that stress in the beginning. You couldn't get a hold of me, but
it's okay. I just ended up reversing you and Frank Cordero, and
okay.
It was a pre-record. I could just turn it on and then try to get a hold of you. So
okay,
it
good.
Fine.
All right, glad. Good. So it worked out. I just again wanted to mention that April is National Poetry Month, and if you can help a poet in some way, either by going to one of their readings or buying a book, supporting poetry, reading a poem, sharing a poem, keeping the culture of poetry alive. I can't believe April whipped by and I didn't do anything for National Poetry Month. I just been so much going on, and you know, it's just been so, it's just wild times, but I'm glad at least got in, you know, the last couple of days. I know it's a big month. I mean, there's Earth Day, there's Easter, there's 420. I mean, there's, you know, it's springtime. It's like April is such, you know, April's a wonderful month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Really.
And, so- I also have, when I think Mike was still on the show and I was reading my series called This Is Your New Alphabet, and it has a similar rhythm than this cat project, but it's very similar. And that book is actually going to be done too. And that's all from your radio show, Chuck, New American Dreams.
Oh, how cool.
I know.
I'm really honored by that.
Yeah, I got to remember to mention that. I'll put it in the beginning when I thank everybody. I got to put that in there because I did write the chapters for this show on both of those books. I know, because I always wanted to have something new and exciting. And, you know, you guys brought me on to do poetry and stuff, so I want to honor that. And you know, it's like I've got so much material. I don't, you know, it sometimes isn't always right in front of me. You know, which is why sometimes we talk about other things. But like you said, that's interesting too, because, you know, it's nice to have a conversation and for us both to have input and, you know, for people to hear a conversation about really important issues that really affect everybody.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate you and the show and Mike too for inviting me, having me on every month, listening, encouraging me, enjoying my work, and having me, you know, motivated to write all this new stuff every month. Wonderful. So thank you. I really appreciate it. I forgot to tell you how much you have contributed to this project and have been part of it.
Well, that makes me feel really, really good, Abba. Thank you very much.
And that you and Lorraine enjoyed it so much really gave me, you know, the energy. It's like, you know, when musicians, you know, they got up on stage in front of a huge stadium of people. And there was, I think it may have been Erica Badu is the one that said, you know, we go off creative people and, you know, we go off the energy of what we're getting if we feel like, you know, if we feel support and love and appreciation and, you know, enjoyment of your work, you do more of it and you keep it going.
Yeah,
but if there's, you know, if there's no audience and nobody's listening and no one cares and nobody likes it anyway, it's easy to not do it. So it's nice to have that appreciation. And that's why I mentioned big about Poetry Month. I'm not necessarily talking about myself, but any poet out there that you can think of to share their work, support them in some way by sharing a poem of theirs or buying one of their books or passing it on a book. It's important because poetry really gets thrown under the, you know, gets swept under the carpet a lot.
Yeah. It's true.
You know, and it can be used. There is a lot of really boring, awful gray poetry out there. In fact, that's what we're mostly exposed to, I think, when we're growing up. There's a little bit of good stuff that we get in school, but we get turned off to it early. But it's such an amazing art form and how you can how you can play with the art form and put so many different things into it, like how I created this piece of, you know, it's like a protest piece, but into a poem, and it just has a different flow and it takes on a different energy than, let's say, a novel would, or a monologue, you know, it's just, it's a really unique art form, and I love it. I know it's very ancient, and there's a reason why.
Yeah.
You know, and
really. Well,
and I appreciate that you have poetry as part of your program, Chuck.
Oh, absolutely. It's a major part. Yes.
It is.
I'm so pleased. But we are now officially out of time, and we've been cutting into Philip's time, but
I'm going to have to call on and on. But
thank you so much.
Talk again, and we'll see you next month. And I got another chapter.
Okay, sounds great.
Lots of love to you in the rain.
Lots of love right back. Okay, thank you. Bye bye. And now we're going to add Philip Ferrugio, a extremely prolific columnist. You find his work all over the internet, but especially at the website that I maintain for him. It's theempirestupid.com. So right now we're trying to call Philip.
Oh.
Hey, there is Philip Ferrugio, and we're sorry to be late getting to you tonight, Philip.
Yeah,
I know.
Is a short one, so we'll go quick.
Okay.
All right, here we go. The Fault, Dear Brutus, Part 2.
Hmm.
Lovers of real American history should recall the words uttered by the late, great newsman and newscaster Edward R. Murrow about Senator Joe McCarthy. During the height of the political witch hunts orchestrated and influenced by the late senator, Murrow took on McCarthy with his show See It Now. At the end of one discourse by Murrow, he quoted from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves." So this writer says it now, after the utter and disgraceful and horrific insurrection at the nation's capital. Of course, it was only the goal and plan to remake our government in Lord Trump's image. That alone would be treasonous and, of course, highly criminal. What really shakes me is how this actual neo-Nazi and white supremacist mindset has been increasingly fermented throughout our nation, especially since Trump took office. Sadly, the anger felt by many of those foolish stooges for Trump has, as usual in many cases of economic and social unrest, been misguided and misplaced. Trump, the quintessential con man demagogue, for most of his adult life has succeeded through this phony populism. Basically, he is similar to those $2,000 suits that stand in front of the altar of packed churches who direct the flock to do their bidding and send in the cash. In another life, Donald Trump would have made the most popular televangelist alive. One cannot reason with those who support this man and his mantra when it comes to abortion and gay people. They will always follow right-wing politicos who bang the drum against a woman's right to choose and a gay person's right to live as such. As to the others, those who are pissed off at how the government does little to leave them more cash in their pockets, they need to take a breath and ponder. The very people who they support and continually elect to office, Republican and or Democrat, with but few exceptions, do not ease their economic pain. Most of the politicians, like Donald Trump, are mega millionaires. You can take noblesse oblige and chuck it out the damn window. Many of those so-called leaders won't even adopt a universal basic income for the hundreds of millions of us who are on thin ice financially, especially due to the pandemic. Yet they vote to increase the obscene military spending, which eats up at least half of our federal discretionary spending. They agreed to continue, as in 2008, 2009, to bail out the corporate giants on Wall Street and in the industry while mom and pop America go under. With neoliberal President Biden and company taking power, joining with the rich man's party across the aisle, they will never allow a monthly universal basic income check to keep our wheels moving. Why? Don't believe the BS by both parties about how fiscally dangerous that would be. Just ask Ellen Brown, expert on public banking and universal basic income, and she will explain how the UBI is not inflationary. On the contrary, it would keep millions of us above water financially, not as an elixir, rather as a remedy to this capitalism on steroids we are enslaved by. For those of my fellow citizens who believe in a God who gave us free will, it's time to use it. Isn't it time for all of us, especially the MAGA stalwarts, to see a stimulated economy that satisfies us working stiffs and not just the fat cats? Thank you.
A very good piece, Philip.
Thank you. Comments? Really?
I don't know what to say.
I realize. I know. The silence is killing us all.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a million people listening to the show right now, and they're going, huh? What?
Where's Chuck Gregory? All right.
Okay, so basically, I'm bringing up the universal basic income. I'm going to keep bringing it up because the two parties and the Democrats, they don't want to even talk about it. They don't even talk about it. Nobody talks about it. It's like they don't want to talk about it. So I don't know what to tell you. They can create money anytime they want. The Federal Reserve, they can always just create electronic money. There's no problem doing that. So why can't they just create the electronic money and give everybody a check every month? Most of the money is going to go back into the economy anyway. You know, I mean, only the very wealthy can afford to hoard it, right? To hoard the money. Chuck Gregory and me and a lot of people on your show, listening to your show, we'll probably use it. We'll use the money to help us with bills and there's a million things that you can. So. Here's the question. Why aren't more of our fellow working stiffs shouting out and demanding that we get this? That's the real that's the conundrum. That's the conundrum we face.
Yeah.
The average neighbor of ours either doesn't even know about it, right? A lot of people don't even know about it. And the ones who heard about it just listen to what they hear on TV. Oh, it'll be inflationary. Oh, it'll cause more inflation, you know? Or, people are going to use it to buy drugs and to buy alcohol and to gamble. Well, yeah, there's a percentage of the population that'll do that.
Yeah, so what? It keeps those industries going, right?
That's right. Boy, I mean, it's funny. Chuck, it's funny how Florida, DeSantis, like they're holding back on allowing recreational marijuana. Like they do the medical, right? They do the medical marijuana.
Yeah.
Now, where I live, there are three medical marijuana places in my town.
There's
two I know of. I think there's another one. Those are the dispensaries, you know, where you go in with your card. Yeah.
Right. So, one of the comedians on one of my shows is always saying, it's the guy down at the corner is a lot cheaper.
to a certain extent. But actually, I get the medical marijuana. The gummies, and I also get the actual marijuana. And I got to tell you, the marijuana that you smoke, that you get, is pretty good quality. It really is.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, no, it is. No, I'm serious. It's
all right.
And as my as my eye doctor attested to, you know, she wouldn't admit it like a year and a half ago, and now she admits it. It does lower your eye pressure.
Yeah.
And if you have what I have, I'm on a glaucoma watch.
It's good
for people like me because it lowers your, your eye pressure. So that makes you feel better.
Yeah.
You know, when you when you're doing it. And, you know, let's face the facts. If Ron DeSantis, if he wants to stay as governor, he's going to have no alternative. He's going to have to push to have it recreational because of the money it's going to take in. The tax money is going to be unbelievable. It's going to be unbelievable. It's like if when they get rid of prohibition, right?
Yeah, right.
The money that the government made on the tax on alcohol was outrageous. So they're going to have to do it, Chuck. They have to. That's why it's being done in other states, because it's bringing in revenue.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, I mean, we're just at a time here where if, you know, one bad, they call it a recession, but not a recession, but one bad financial crisis. I mean, a lot of our friends and neighbors, maybe me, I don't know, we're all going to be up the creek, you know? I mean,
yeah.
I mean,
all
of
it.
Scary.
Yeah.
It's scary.
And
the rents are outrageous.
Yeah.
How many times I come on your show and I say the same thing? I mean, it's just, no, it's true, though.
Well, the absentee landlord, what's going on? Yeah. Yeah.
But you know it. I mean, come on. You must see it where you live, right? You must talk to other people. I mean, people who are renting apartments and don't have any assistance, any government assistance. The prices are unbelievable. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, I think I told you once before, his mom passed away in, Boca Raton. I think it was Boca Raton. And it was a town not too far from you, you know, in that area. And she had a house. And he said it was a simple house. It wasn't a fancy house that she owned. You know, I think it was like 1,500 square feet, you know. And he said his sisters and him inherited it because she passed away. And he said, no, he said, we're not going to sell it. He said, because we can make a lot of money. He said, we're renting it. And I said, how much are you going to get? He says about $2,500, $2,700 a month. God, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. I mean, that's not New York City. That's Florida, you know? I mean, how can a family, a husband and wife, working, you know, making, I don't know, to each making maybe 30,000-40,000 a year total. They're making 60, like my wife and I, making what, 60,000 a year total? How could you afford to pay $2,700 a month in rent? You can't.
Yeah. Right.
And then you got to pay for that. You got to pay for the electric, the water, you know, you got to pay for everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So how are people able to do this all over the country? They're not. I mean, they're able to do it if they have to, but it means getting a second job. You know, that's why they passed the bill. Was it in Iowa where they're going to allow child labor? You probably saw that, right?
I don't think so.
Yeah, Iowa just passed the bill. They're going to allow like kids 12 years old to work in factories.
Really? Wow.
I mean meatpacking plants. Yeah, 12-year-olds. Now, most of the 12-year-olds are going to be children of the immigrants, I guess a lot of them are probably illegal, but that's where they're going to get their labor pool from, you know, because you got a lot of, Latinos that go up to all. Did you ever see the movie Fast Food Nation?
No.
Oh, you got to see this movie.
Huh.
Everybody listening to this, Fast Food Nation, I don't know, it came out 6, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago. You got to see this movie. It's about the fast food, you know, the meat fast food industry, and they show you. It's not a documentary, but it's like a documentary, and they show you all these meatpacking plants in Colorado. You know, Colorado. That's where they were showing it in the movie, And these are all undocumented.
Huh.
They all go up there from Mexico and whatever, and to find jobs, and they put them in these meat plants, and they don't pay them a lot of money. Obviously, it's not union, you know. It's not. People got to work in the worst conditions. Plus, they showed you in the movie how a lot of the young women are being taken advantage of by the people that run these packing plants.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, like the foreman, the superintendent, all those people.
Yeah, sure.
They'll pick out a good-looking girl, you know. And they take advantage of them because the girl needs a job, you know. But it's just a sad situation. And then, of course, when you watch the movie, you would never eat a hamburger again. Trust me. You watch this movie, I promise you, I would never, unless you know exactly a place where they're grinding their own meat. Okay, if you go to a place that makes hamburgers and they're grinding their own meat, other than that, you would never eat a hamburger again watching this movie.
Well,
what goes into the plant, the rodents.
If it's going to have that effect on me, I might not watch it. I don't know. I like my hamburger.
Chuck, that's... Chuck, are you a hamburger lover?
Yeah, I like hamburgers, yeah.
Well, don't watch this movie, because when you see what goes into that meat, you're not going to watch the movie.
There was a famous book.
It's called The Jungle.
Yeah, exactly.
Upton Sinclair. Yeah,
okay.
I read that book again a couple of years ago because I hadn't read it since I was in high school or college.
Yeah.
Is that it? We're all done?
We are.
Okay.
Thank you, Philip. Sorry it was a little shorter,
but it's okay. I'll talk to you
soon. It was interesting. Yeah.
You take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick. Welcome to the crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm. As expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show. Thank you for staying with me through the station break. I hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on the New American Dream Radio Show, right here on Revolution Radio. Remember, it's a listener-supported network, and they really do deserve your support. There's lots of ways you can do it. Just take a look at revolution.radio and find one of the ways that you can help support this great project, bringing free speech to all of us. Very important deal. My next guest of the evening is going to be Michael Annis. Michael joins me in this fourth week of the month from Denver, and I'm going to add him into the show right now. Michael is a multi-talented guy with he's a publisher, a poet, musician, and here he is. Michael, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Well, hi, Chuck. It's good to be back on the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm glad to hear your voice. I'm glad to hear your voice and know that you weren't washed away in all the flooding in Florida.
Yeah, no problem.
National news, Fort Lauderdale, the first time Fort Lauderdale had been in my memory, had been in the national news.
Ah, yeah, well. It was,
so are
it
you
was
broadcasting from a raft, or what are you doing down there?
Hey, that was a couple weeks ago. That's old news now, yeah.
Oh, I know. I'm an old news guy. Okay.
Really?
In fact, I'm such an old news guy that I'm going to present some old news here.
All right.
Okay. And I hope I don't get us in trouble with the censors again. I've tried to scour out all the four-letter words I usually use with abandon whenever I'm speaking with somebody. Mm-hmm. So I've eliminated those. So I think we're pretty set and safe to go.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. We push enough limits with what we say. That we don't need to have problems about how we say it. You know
how we say it. Oh my God. Talk about old news. We're going back to the argument between Ernest Hemingway and Gertrude Stein back in the 1930s, you know, in Paris, mm-hmm. when Hemingway said, "I write the way people talk."
Mm-hmm.
She wanted him to write, you know, a little more dignified, huh. Not knowing that he would eventually win the Nobel Prize in Literature. But I guess that doesn't count. I guess that we must censor our words. Anyway, tonight I present a tribute to Harry Belafonte, a man that we lost 2 days ago on April 25th, yes. A huge loss in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely.
Also, you know, go ahead.
The very first concert that I ever saw was Harry Belafonte. It was at the University of Cincinnati, and my parents took me to it because they were big
fabulous
fans.
Fabulous.
And it was just wonderful. That must have been, I don't know, late 50s, early 60s, you know, because I was pretty little.
Yeah. He was young and in his heyday at that point in time.
Oh.
at least as far as entertainer, you know, musically.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
he came on politically a little bit later in life, but then he was like, he was the thing. So also I'm going to offer some opinions by myself generated by his loss and a few poems relevant to his causes that appeared in Cost of Freedom, the Anthology of Peace and Activism, which a publication that he endorsed. I don't know if you remember that or not, but he did.
Hmm.
Yeah, I corresponded with him a little bit.
Yeah.
And so here we go. With each succeeding generation, the powers of the political, social, and cultural structure hoisting the umbrella of governance over our heads scrub the chalkboard clean so there is no residue. No ghost images left of the lessons learned from the generations before us. If you seek out those lessons in a premeditated manner, a fashion of system retrieval of whatever progress had been made from issues brought up before, you might find, after wading through the propaganda, what you are needing to continue the fight for essential humanitarian values and for preservation of the biosphere without having to take two steps backward to go one step forward. Every generation, we are victimized by the premeditated and planned obsolescence of comprehensive human and planetary history, such as your governor down there in Florida is doing right now out in the open, either being too bold or too condescending or too dumb to realize that what he is advocating openly is only a continuity of subliminal behind-the-curtain erosion of what we remember and how we remember it. We should remember this quote by George Santayana: "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it." That quote implies a comprehensive, not selective past, a written-down past, a past of recorded history, and not simply hearsay, bias, and not so informed opinion. My opinion is that the work for racial justice should have been completed when Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were living and leading the revolutionary causes. But we are still flailing along here with petty prejudices and all-encompassing fears of one another. Witness what happened in the Tennessee and Montana legislatures recently, when a few of their congresspeople presented differing views from the majority. Humans terrified of humans. We're still battling the propaganda that keeps us from doing whatever is most beneficial for all of humanity, for doing what we have to do right now to alleviate and prevent the worst of climate meltdown and climate cataclysm. In our quest for continual entertainment, we have forfeited the quest for truth, choosing instead obeisance to the machinery of propaganda and rationale. We lost a true hero of human evolution this week. And I speak of human evolution in the sense that he taught, along with Martin Luther King, the absolutely critical need for us as a species to all bond together in love and commonalities, producing freedom and liberation for all human beings. Harry Belafonte was 96 when he died. He lived his life fighting against racial, economic, social, and political injustice. And my co-editors, Mike Palachek and Whitney Tretine, and I were so very honored when he got behind what we were doing when I published Cost of Freedom, the Anthology of Peace and Activism. Harry Belafonte lent his voice to affirm the work we were doing in bringing together over 100 poets and artists in a unified effort to expose the lies, deceit, and contempt of the United States political powers of the time, led by George W. Bush, in its invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. Mr. Belafonte gave us a brilliant testimonial and was joined with testimonials by Free Speech TV, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Ralph Nader, Pete Seeger, and many very important others in lifting up our work publicly. Harry Belafonte marched with Martin Luther King and helped to fund some of the efforts of that movement. He was the first recording artist in history to sell over 1 million copies of his work. That's how artistically gifted he was, and that is what launched him to be an influence on generations of his own time and to come. Not only did he dedicate his life to fight racism through his talents and influence, he was an actor, a supremely intelligent and exquisitely gifted orator, a musician-singer with the voice of an angel, and above all else, a champion for the outcasts, the underprivileged, the profoundly disabled, socially challenged, and otherwise downtrodden part of the human race. We owe Harry Belafonte far more than respect as a nation. He collaborated in attempting to bring forth the highest station, aspirations, and achievements of humanity for all individuals, embodied by the tenet liberty, equality, and justice for all. Well, I'm going to offer a few quotes by Harry Belafonte, and then I'll read from Cost of Freedom to also celebrate April as National Poetry Month. First, however, I want to bring up something that deeply outraged me today, because what happened is the perfect example of what I have been saying as the scouring of history. There is a morning show on NBC, the Today Show with Hoda and Jenna, the Jenna component being the daughter of ex-President George W. Bush. Let me see. How is it she landed the co-anchor position on a national network? Well, it shouldn't be a mystery. It's because she has so many interesting things to say, saying them with such lucid articulation of her many profound insights into life and culture. So this morning, she claimed she had read a book, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I'll give her the possibility of this, the benefit of the doubt. She confessed that it wasn't the type of book she normally reads, and it made me ponder, what type of book does she normally read? This particular book is set and takes place in the not-too-distant and ominous future. And the message of the book is that we need to stop being so violent to one another if we want to survive. Well, I'm pleased that she grasped that. The expression on her face betrayed the idea that she felt like she was now in possession of secret knowledge that she must share with all the viewers, a cautionary warning about where we might be headed if we don't stop being so violent. I found this outrageous. I found this so outrageous that it was hard for me to shake it. I remember being on a vacation with my family to see David and Judy Ray, the poets, both of whom I have published. In fact, David's book, The Death of Sardanapalus, was hailed as the single greatest book of poetry against the Iraq War, the invasion put together by Jenna's dad, George. David was also a prominent contributor to Cost of Freedom. In 2003, on our visit to Tucson, David, my son, and I were sitting in David's studio watching the television in horror when the United States Bush administration launched Shock and Awe on Iraq. By the way, that administration was saturated with oil executives, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Condi Rice, and others. Why were we there? We were there to liberate the Iraqis from Saddam. No, we were there to grab oil. As the city of Baghdad lit up in horrendous flames and explosions on television, I remember looking over at David and my son and saying, those children there who aren't exterminated and survive this will be profoundly disabled and debilitated the rest of their lives, physically, emotionally, and psychically. They will hate the United States with its blood money lust for oil and do everything they can to bring us down. So I wonder if Jenna has ever considered the history of that ultraviolet act by her father and his buddies in her need to warn all her morning show viewers of the repercussions of violence she now campaigns against? Or is she familiar with words of Harry Belafonte, who said that her father, George W. Bush, was the greatest terrorist of our time? The term I use for minds like Jenna's is malevolent somnolence. A vampirish sleepwalking through life where one expects other minds to be filled with sleepiness that prevents them from grasping hold of reality and truth, which is a variety of self-willed, self-imposed ignorance to anything that might make them uncomfortable. It's malevolent because it works to deceive the minds of those who listen to and believe them. Harry Belafonte quotes as follows. Number one, movements don't die because struggle doesn't die. Number two, fascism is fascism. Terrorism is terrorism. Oppression is oppression. Number three, peace is necessary. For justice it is necessary. For hope it is necessary. For our future. Number four, without the rebellious heart, without people who understand that there's no sacrifice we can make that is too great to retrieve that which we've lost, we will forever be distracted with possessions and trinkets and title. Number five, I call President Bush a terrorist. I call those around him terrorists as well. Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, Gonzalez in the Justice Department, and certainly Cheney. Harry Belafonte said of Cost of Freedom, and it's printed on its back cover along with half a dozen other ones by very prominent figures, people who should know what they're talking about, who fought the good fight for a long, long time. Harry said, there is good reason to have at your disposal things that remind you of things as they are. Cost of Freedom is a perfect candidate. It does more than remind. It also informs. So now, I don't know how much time I have left, but I will read a few poems from Cost of Freedom, published as an outcry against that war, and fundamentally prescient as an outcry to Putin's war upon Ukraine and all other wars concocted by authoritarians and propagandists to destroy their enemies while securing their own power and enriching the corporations and billionaires who manipulate the remainder of the human race. And the first quote, or the first entry from Cost of Freedom that I would like to read is by David Ray. It is more or less the opening statement in the book by a living writer. And, let's see, it goes as follows. This is by David Ray. The history of wars, including the present ones, could probably be documented more accurately by the almost entirely suppressed literature of dissent, if it could be resurrected, than by the printed accounts that will go down as truth. Such work is ignored or abolished with a thoroughness worthy of Stalin's erasures of history. As one who had written almost daily against war, I know the pain and frustration of those who are unheard, who cannot get their opinions into the crucial dialogues that should be taking place, no matter how reasonably or diplomatically they try. Needless to say, none who voluntarily served administration propaganda have apologized, and only a few congressmen, for example, former Senators Kerry, have shown regrets. I have concluded that any expression of dissent toward a dominant, deceitful, and criminal administration increases one's alienation not only from those who support the war, but also from people in general. The level of fear about speaking up, though seldom acknowledged, is at a high level. References to writings of witness and protest are glibly dismissed as, in quotes, political. Well, I prefer the term, in quotes, humanitarian, for I regard issues of war and peace, life or death, as concerns transcending the merely political, though in a sense, our every act, gesture, and conversation is political. David Ray. How much time do I have, Chuck?
You have 10 minutes or more.
Oh, okay, great. He lights up. He lights up with glee.
Okay, I thought you'd like that.
Yeah, okay, so...
All right.
So now the first actual poem by David, okay. David Ray. By the way, David, who I published several times, won the William Carlos Williams, the only poet who won ever to have won the William Carlos Williams Award twice. And he writes in a manner in which he makes it sound so simplistic in the structure and the way he does it that one is misled into thinking that maybe it isn't even a poem. Maybe it's just dialogue or conversation. But I'm gonna go with this. One of my favorite poets of all time, David Ray, and a dear friend. No mention of impeachment. Cock on a dunghill crowing while busy creating the dung. He's not Hitler because he doesn't speak German. When the casualties equal Vietnam's 58,000. Perhaps he will be satisfied. The good people of America, like blind sheep, follow him off the cliff. Lofted by enough propaganda to float a ship, he appears at the podium. As soon as the euphemisms are turned out, the newspapers oblige. The language is amended daily. Escalation of war is now a surge. But war is not a tidal wave or other act of nature or God. It is man-made. Hunger no longer exists in America, but millions have, in quotes, very low food security, end quotes. This man appeared in New Orleans, then disappeared on a tight schedule. With two stolen elections, he looks forward to his brother stealing a third. His list of missions accomplished includes an awesome carnage. "Stop me before I kill more," scrawled William Hirons, a serial killer in Chicago. Hirons used lipstick, but this man prefers his history scrawled with barrels of blood. So much is drained in the morgues of Iraq that it could surpass the production of oil. This man keeps saying he cannot stand those who kill innocent people. QED, none of the people killed in his, in quotes, war on terror, end quotes, are innocent. Americans worry about not having a traditional white Christmas. Iraqis do not. A national election is clearly an effort to find the least qualified leader. What is the difference between the power of a medieval king and this man? The nation waits for his next disastrous decision and will respect it. The media happily censor any mention of the subject of impeachment. Aye, impeachment is an unspeakable possibility unless it's for sexual folly. Alas, 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 we forbid ourselves to think, to refuse to follow. As Irwin Shaw pointed out, war will never end until soldiers refuse to be buried.
Okay, let's see. There was in Cost of Freedom, it's really interesting that not only did David, another poet, originally a New York, originally who found his poetic calling in New York, Greenwich Village and so forth, the poet W.H. Auden keeps coming up in their poems. It's not like we planned this. And also Whitney Tretien wrote something about W.H. Auden, one of my co-editors. But W.H. Auden was a prominent figure and an anti-war poet. So in David's next poem, Sheep, he begins with a quote by W.H. Auden. And the quote goes, "So long as we consent to live like sheep and never mention those who disappear, our dream of safety has to disappear." Why is it that, as Auden noted in a poem, we prefer to look away from disaster and sail on with our own concerns as if we are all little sailing caravels? Why is it that certain parts of the earth, be they islands or deserts or nations, are regarded as of no consequence, though we are well aware of the suffering, since our odd voyeurism allows us to catch up on the news from living room or bed or even when we sit on our stools? When was it that we learned not to care? When did we decide we could honor fools as if they are kings, immune from all laws, free to torture or wage wars based on lies? Although in textbooks dealing with history, we studied nothing more foolish than treating such leaders as if they were anointed by God. We only stop short of kissing our president's hand, and some may go even farther in homage. One thing is so obvious, it should not need to be noted. The White House and certain centers of power should be called the Office for Planning the Perpetuation of Suffering. We have seen how all our government leaders for a week watched the spectacle of people in New Orleans starving and wading in sewage, their homes destroyed, no evacuation possible. We have seen our president and Secretary of State tell another government to bomb civilians a few more weeks before agreeing to a ceasefire. We have seen a strange schizophrenic world replace one we were promised by utopian philosophers, including our own founding fathers. We have been betrayed by being forced into complicity, committing acts more obscene than those for which serial killers are executed. Yes, these are our crimes, if our money and silence have financed them. I have bought cluster bombs and done nothing. As the Janjaweed gallop through Darfur villages, mutilating, raping, killing, when have I lifted a finger? When, dear neighbor, have you? Only your sheepish baa do I hear in the night.
That's... I have a couple more here. I really think I'm going to focus on some of David's work tonight because he was so outspoken.
Okay.
And obviously that's why I'm sorry?
That was so powerful. So yes, I definitely like to hear.
Okay, so his book that I published, I think it was in 2004. I went through hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of poems to come up with the book that was approximately 150 pages long. I'll have to look at it again. It was called The Death of Sardanapalus and Other Poems of the Iraq Wars. And it was considered at the time to be the single greatest poetic work against war.
Mm.
Now, here's an irony which troubles me to no end. David Ray is not even included in the Academy of American Poets, even though he has produced poems of such utter monstrous strength and clarity that he should have been included long, long, long ago. But, you know, there's politics everywhere, and I'm not saying that everybody in the Academy of American Poets is political by nature, but I find it outrageous that he's not in the Academy of American Poets. He has published so many books, of which I have published several, and he has won prizes, and he has appeared in very prestigious literary magazines, and he was essential in the creation of Cost of Freedom, his work, his ideas. Okay, another one. Here we go. Reflection. These are all about George W. Bush and that administration and that time period. But David has published and written far, far newer work, you know, criticizing other administrations too. I'm just reading out of the Cost of Freedom here now. Everything that I'm reading now is from Cost of Freedom.
Okay.
Okay. Reflection. Our leader is a hollow man, they say. Wooden-headed, not very bright. Misled by others who are Machiavellian, while he is not. Yet he is the man who gives orders. And when he does, many die, and they are just as dead as if a great warrior has downed them. But to the dead, does it matter what manner of fool or monster, charming or crude, sent them to their deaths? Using weapons fueled by enough propaganda
to lift great planes and missiles off the ground and send them in graceful flight around the earth?
Okay. One more here. Let me know when I'm going over. I have enough here for two shows. Chuck, I have enough for two. I hope you find it heartwarming.
let's go with one more and then close things off.
Okay. Auden-esque. David Reyes, Auden-esque. First a quote by W.H. Auden. That is why we despair. This is the abomination. This is the wrath of God. Is this man the outrageous novelty the poet predicted? A man introduced into our lives by a stolen election? Is this man the long-awaited freak of nature, the regressive mutation, or the archetype of the father with heart of stone, who sends sons and daughters of others to die for nothing? Nothing but scorched sand and strewn body parts? Or could he be the long-awaited Antichrist come to bring about Armageddon? No, no, not so, for this is a simple God-fearing man who loves his daughters, whom he will not send to his war, although he believes in it with all his heart. This is the man whose banality is unsurpassed by even the most subtle of actors. This is a man of no eloquence who nevertheless triggered a war with the fervor of his lies. This is a man who still shames those who do not love his war enough to sacrifice the blood of their loved ones to it. This is a man of the most remarkable banality, and he is spared all awareness of his evil because he has never and will never read works of the great pessimists who have predicted him, known and feared throughout the centuries, that he would, in due time, arrive.
Mm. Wow.
So he was, of course, speaking of George W. Bush, but he speaks of all of these political tyrants hiding behind a silly grin in a casual manner speaking. It doesn't make any difference if they're Russians or Americans or British or French or Chinese or South American or African. It makes no difference. Difference at all. He's speaking of each one of them whose whole quest in life is to divide and conquer the people for their own sake of power. And they will send people, not their own, they will send other people's children off to be slaughtered for their own personal gain. And with that, I close out.
Well, all right.
I hope Jenna Bush was listening. Because evidently she doesn't know the history of her own family.
All right, then. Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, Chuck, thanks for having me on again. I don't think I used a single four-letter word, did I?
No, I think you did very well. You're very well behaved, yes.
Well, hallelujah. Can I get
right,
an amen?
Okay, yeah. Amen.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
All right.
I'll be on again next month, I hope.
Excellent.
Okay.
I look forward to it. Yeah.
Okay. All right, my friend.
Thanks again. Okay.
Bye.
Good. Bye-bye. Well, listeners, our final guest of the evening is Karen Katowski. Karen joins us in this fourth week of each month from Virginia. And Karen's a fascinating person. She was a lieutenant colonel in the Marines and stationed at the Pentagon during 9/11. So that was probably how I first got to find out about her. But she's so much more. Very intelligent person who analyzes and researches. And we're very fortunate to have her as a regular guest on the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm going to add her in right now. And once again, Karen will be joining us from somewhere in Virginia. Hello, Karen. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. All right.
Yeah, great to be here. So I guess I had kind of forgotten about the show, but I did actually have an article at Lou Rockwell today. Finally. Yeah, so I want to talk just a little bit about that. But it was about the 2024 presidential race, and of course RFK Jr. is announced as a Democratic candidate. And he announced I guess a few weeks ago, and of course we know Joe sent out a midnight video announcing his candidacy. Yeah, he's gonna run for re-election, old Joe.
Yeah.
and you know, RFK did it in a traditional way. You know, he had a big a hotel filled with supporters, and he gave an hour and a half long or more speech with no notes, talking about why he was running. It's really spectacular, and you can, I believe there's a link. I put a link to the video in my article, but you can find it pretty easily. And just amazing listening to him and talk about his life, his experiences, and why he was running, and some of his critique. I just think anybody that listens to this show and many others will very much appreciate RFK Jr.'s critique of the problems we have in this country and what some of the causes of these problems are and what some of the solutions might be. But it was just wonderful to listen to him. It's very different than listening to your average politician. And certainly in recent times, you know, we have a Trump and we have a Biden and their teams. And listening to RFK Jr., very, very different, very, very different. As Trump would say, was tremendous. It was the best, you know. How did Trump, I love Trump's over, you know, how he over the top with his descriptions. I mean, that's actually how I feel about you know, RFK's presentation. And of course, so Biden earlier this week came out with his announcement that he's going to run for reelection, videoed, no live. Mm-hmm. All choreographed and a lot of emotional music and imagery. I don't even know how to describe those 3 minutes, but it was divisive and at the same time very untrue. The things he was saying, I mean, the things he's promoting kind of to appeal to mainstream America, when in fact, at the same speech, he's dividing people into us and them and the enemies and all that. So terrible guy. I mean, I'm no fan of Joe Biden, but then right after Joe announced, and I guess it was Tuesday of this week when he put that video out, 3 a.m, I think it was. Shortly after that, I mean, within days. Now, they already knew the Democrats have other candidates. You have RFK, who's announced, and I believe Marianne Williamson has announced also, and she was in the primaries last time for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So she's an interesting person. I do not follow her stuff, and I don't have any information on her. But there are two people that would like to primary that are prime. I'm sorry, not like to, are running for the Democratic Party. And basically, within a day of Biden's announcement, the Democratic Party machine said that there will be no primary debates. There will be no primary debates. So, you know, I mean,
really?
Shut down your opposition. You know, but they're Democrats, you know, and Democrats are all about equality of access, you know, and equality of everybody has this. Everybody has rights, you know, but I guess they don't.
If only.
They don't really. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's just words, you know. We'll see how much traction these other candidates get. They are RFK is, you know, the things that he's talking about, he's been talking about for a long time, but they really are necessary for Americans to hear. And what, of course, I liked, there were a couple things I liked about it, because I'm, you know, not a Democrat. I don't recall voting Democratic or being particularly attracted to any Democratic platforms per se. But he had the right answer. He had the populist centrist answer on Ukraine, which is we shouldn't be over there without a congressional declaration of war, which we don't have. And he also, he's good on corporate capitalism, crony capitalism. He gets all that. He talked about regulatory capture. An example. Now he's studied and worked in pharmaceutical side of, understanding what's happening there. And, you know, he sees pharmaceutical capture, regulatory capture, particularly in the pharmaceutical industry, where you have this in and out between CEOs of big pharma and the FDA, you know, FDA offices and appoint the CDC. You know, it's just a revolving door. And of course, my experience isn't that. My background, more military, see the exact same thing in the Defense Department, exact same thing. And we also see it in Treasury and JP Morgan and the financial sector, you know, the banking sector. We see the same, you know, so we say, oh, regulate the banks. Who's going to regulate the banks? The guy that works for the banks is going to regulate the banks, because they share jobs. They exchange positions periodically. But he's talking about these things that I think most of us are, if we're not aware of them, we certainly see the results of them. And he's talking about it, and he's explaining it in really, for a guy from, you know, Boston, I guess, certainly the New England, I'm sure he's pretty well educated, but he explains things that regular people can understand. It. I mean, he comes across in a very approachable way. Anyway, very impressed with him. I think people should get that, should see what he has to say, because what he has to say is actually quite dangerous speech, which is great. And then, of course, linking to this a little bit, connecting to it in just this week, is the whole saga of why Fox News, which I thought was supposedly, you know, conservative, but we all know that it's not. It's just another state-run news agency to appeal to the other half of the audience that's out there to sell ads to them. But Fox News fired its best or its most profitable and most watched news anchor. What's the guy's name? No, it escapes me. You know who I'm talking about. He just got fired from Fox. The guy that has the talk show at 8 o'clock. Huh?
Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson. Yes. See, I don't get Fox News. I like Tucker. I don't watch him. I watch him on, like, if he does a show that's interesting, I'll see it on YouTube. You know, I don't watch it live. But in any case, the whole thing going on with Twitter and in some of the news media, and of course the liberals are cackling, and the liberal media, New York Times, Washington Post, they love it. You know, here's this guy's asking hard questions. He just got fired. Well, the thing on Twitter and all around, people that are thinking about this, they're all asking the same question with different answers. And that is, which broadcast got Tucker fired? And so they're all picking their favorite broadcast where he poked fun at the government or held it accountable or critiqued the lies of the war or whatever. And the war could be anywhere. Particularly the war we're in now with Ukraine, but you could include Syria. You could talk about lies about Afghanistan. There's many. Anytime we go to war, we lie. So there's lots of material.
I'm pretty sure that what got him fired was the lawsuit that Fox settled, getting rid of their most prominent, most visible person makes it appear that they are doing something to clean up their act or whatever.
Right.
And that way they don't really have to make any changes.
Yeah, well, it's
I'm sorry, that's a cynical, thought, but
that actually could be it. In fact, you know, that's the first thing that I read about it was it was related to the lawsuit in some way, and also in discovery, Tucker had said some critical things about the people at Fox, and you know how people are. I don't like this guy, get rid of him. You know, he insulted me or whatever. So there's lots of good. But my point is not why he got fired, but what's going on with Twitter and Facebook and in the newspapers where they're speculating on what it was he said that got him fired when he was the number one guy, number one moneymaker for that news channel. So they're all speculating. Now, this is what our country has turned into. Speech is not free. And this is what RFK talked about. He says he recognizes as a Kennedy saying the things that he's saying about elite control of this government, elite control in the country, wars of profit, major industrial regulatory capture. You know, the government really can't even do, if you like the government to do things, it can't do those things. If you don't like it to do all the things that it does, you can't change that either. So no left and right, you know, conservative, liberal, none of us have an ability to influence the government. It is beyond our control. And he's speaking to that. And he recognizes in making these criticisms, he says in his own speech the night that he, announced that he is taking a risk, and he realizes the danger of what he's doing, which is just amazingly shocking because this is supposed to be the freest and best country on the planet, where we have open, you know, democracy and people have a right to say what they want. And so you've got JFK telling his people he knows it's dangerous to do what he's doing, but he's going to do it. You have Tucker, who's leaving a network, and the main point of discussion on the interwebs and in the newspapers is, what did he say that got him fired? Was it on his show? Was it in the notes that they got from Discovery where he criticized his bosses? What is it that he said? Did he say something racist? What is it that he said that got him fired? And so everybody in the country, right, left, and center, understand that we do not have free speech in this country. We do not have it. We cannot have it. If we had it, we wouldn't be entertaining ourselves with what did he say that got him fired.
Yeah, really.
But we wouldn't be seeing candidates like RFK, who comes from a political family, of course, a very tragic political family, kind of echoing that if you do and say the wrong things to the wrong people in this country, you will be killed. And he told the story.
Yeah.
He told the story not just of his father, but the story of his uncle. Of course, both assassinated. Both assassinated by powers in this country. Not lone gunmen and not people that just woke up in a bad mood one day, but an organized assassination that had the hands, that had the fingerprints of the state. Some aspect of the state was on that. And a great many long list of reasons the state was angered by these people. So he echoes that. Anyway, it's very interesting that's because, you know, I think of myself and maybe some of us, you know, we're maybe either too cynical or we're maybe on the edge. We're a little bit worried that the country's going downhill too fast. And we're actually, you know, you could say, oh, you're too worried. Relax, relax. But here we have mainstream people. Tucker Carlson's dad was a CIA agent. Okay. Worked for the CIA. He's not some fringe lunatic. You know, he's a mainstream media personality. You know, he comes across as that he sincerely believes what he says. Whether he does or not, you know, we don't know that. But he's not some off-the-wall guy at Ruby Ridge that we need to get rid of, or marginalize. But he is also the enemy of the state. So it doesn't take much, I guess is what I'm saying. It does not take much these days to be an enemy of the state. And we need to be aware of that, because more and more of us are going to wake up as enemies of the state, and we are not going to even know it. Because that's where we're at.
I often wonder if any of us are not enemies of the state.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think it's true. And, you know, the state brings a great deal of power and a great deal of machinery, you know, institutional machinery and whatever to do things about their enemies. And we as people, as individuals, bring, you know, we really, as individuals, we don't bring them up. We have what we have, you know. And we can be fired like Tucker. We can be threatened like JFK. And anyway, I do recommend people go look at that. I'm saying not JFK, RFK Jr., of course, JFK.
Right.
But I do recommend people go look at that video because it was just fantastic. And you say, oh, I can't listen to something for an hour and a half. Trust me, get just start it. Just start it. You'll listen to it. It's very, very good. It's well worth it. Well worth it. He says a lot of interesting things. He tells some very interesting stories. And, of course, for people that remember his life, you know, he goes all the way back to when he was a kid. So that spans our lifetimes, too. He's a little older than we are, but not much. And so his stories are really things we somewhat remember at our age. Now, younger people, I think, will also find it interesting because they don't know anything about this stuff, and he tells good stories. So it's well worth it. Just start, find the YouTube and listen to it. You'll listen to it till the end, and you'll be moved and you'll be inspired. And I'm not saying go out and vote for the guy. Heck, he's not going. What ballot's he going to be on? The Democratic machine's already made up their mind. It's going to be Biden's. You know, they don't care.
Most likely.
Sure. I mean, so it's not about, you know, we're going to support this guy for president. You know, we're going to go make sure people vote for him. It's not about that. Just listen to him and then share it with 10 people and let them listen to him because he's articulating things that we don't often get to hear. And again, I think Tucker Carlson was articulating a lot of things we don't get to hear either. He's gone from that platform. Say he's gone, you know, he'll have other platforms and whatever, but I think the state media and the state itself is really feeling the pressure. I think they're feeling the pressure.
I hope so. They should be.
Yes. And at some point, they should become afraid of us. And there will be a dangerous zone when they are actually afraid.
And that'll be a dangerous time.
It will. It'll be a dangerous time. But still, I think it was Jefferson or maybe attributed to him. But, you know, people shouldn't be afraid of their government. The government.
Yeah. Thank you, Karen.
Okay, we'll be talking next time.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you, listeners. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what...